Hello, listeners. Yamina here. Welcome to the Dr. GPCR podcast. Before we dive into this episode, I have a few announcements to make. We are launching our GPCR consulting services. More information will be available soon. In the meantime, if you need support with your R&D project, understanding the pharmacology of your receptor, or need help getting an idea off the ground, email us at hello@drgpcr.com. We have fantastic talks coming up at the Dr. GPCR Virtual Cafe. Visit drgpcr.com/virtual-cafe to see our upcoming live events. Get your tickets today on Eventbrite. Don't forget, space is limited. To become a speaker or to sponsor an event, you can fill out the form on the main page of the Virtual Cafe. Go to drgpcr.com/virtual-cafe today. Are you subscribed to our monthly newsletter? Stay on top of all your GPCR news by subscribing today at drgpcr.com/newsletter. Also, to watch previous episodes of the Dr. GPCR Virtual Cafe or the podcast episodes, subscribe to our YouTube channel today. Last but not least, stay tuned for more information about the upcoming Dr. GPCR Summit held between September 13th and 19th, 2021. Visit drgpcr.com/summit for more information and how to submit your talk. And now, let's dive in. Hello, everyone. This is Yamina from Dr. GPCR. I'm excited today to have with me Dr. Catherine Livingston. She is currently a product manager at a company called Gator Bio, but her field of interest, obviously, since this is a Dr. GPCR podcast, has been GPCR. She completed her postdoc in Dr. Mark Vranzastro's lab, and we're excited to talk to you today, Catherine. Hi.
Hi, thanks for having me. I'm excited to be on here.
Absolutely. Thanks for coming along, and especially with the time difference between the East Coast and the West Coast, I'm glad we were able to find a time to chat. So can you give us a little bit of background about yourself?
Sure. So I got my BS in chemistry from Carnegie Mellon University, and my research there was very away from biology. It was very inorganic chemistry, spectroscopy, gold nanoclusters. And so I knew I wanted to move towards a more biological realm. And so I went and got my PhD in pharmacology at University of Michigan. And there I worked with Dr. John Treanor, who is an opioid pharmacologist, and fell in love with GPCRs there at University of Michigan. There were so many good GPCR researchers there at that institution. And so really got lucky to kind of fall into GPCRs and fell in love with them. After I did my PhD, I then went to Dr. Mark Vranzastro's lab at UCSF and completed a postdoc there. And so his lab, of course, more cell biology, cell trafficking, visualization methods. And from there, then I went to Gator Bio to start my new life.
So tell me a little bit more about how you came to choosing your PhD lab.
Sure, that's a great question. So from my BS, I knew that I wanted to do pharmacology just because my father actually was a forensic toxicologist. And so he studied, he looked for controlled substances in bodily fluids of people who had committed crimes to kind of see, were they under the influence and did this change how they did the crime? And I thought that was fascinating that these foreign substances could act on the body and cause effects. And then I also have a deep interest and personal connection with kind of mental disorders. And there I learned that those too have roots and causes that are innate and biological, even though they manifest as these psychological things that are kind of how we perceive the world, but they too have these physiological roots. And so from there, I kind of realized that those two are the same and that the link is GPCRs a lot of times, right? GPCRs are controlling our dopamine and our serotonin and our all of these molecules that are giving us perception and memory and thought and sadness are really rooted in GPCRs. And so it was there that I really fell in love with these entities and wanted to learn about them more. And so that's why what brought me to University of Michigan was GPCRs, pharmacology. And so I did a few rotations there and rotated actually with Dr. Roger Sudhahara, Dr. Richard Neubig. So kind of these other GPCR people in the field. Yeah. And ended up with John Treanor, and it was a fantastic lab. The mentorship was amazing. The project was amazing. And just the whole community there at Michigan in GPCRs was really fantastic and really supportive.
It is. And I think it still is in that sense. I'm just surprised that you went from inorganic chemistry to pharmacology. What took you, how come you ended up, you started out in an inorganic chemistry program?
I don't know. I don't know. I should have done biology, to be honest. I should have done biology. I think it was a matter of not really knowing. Both my parents got BSs in chemistry, and I did okay at chemistry in college. So it was kind of, okay, I'll follow in the footsteps. But my summer programs were always in either a psychology or pharmacology related things. So I was either interning at, you know, a psychiatrist's office or a pharmacologist during the summers. And so it was during those summers that I really figured out what I actually liked.
And this takes us back to a very important point that you're making, is that you need to go out there and create those experiences for yourself in order to realize what you like and what you don't like. Not just, you know, follow the regular coursework, because if you don't figure out early enough what you like, then you may miss the opportunity of getting into the field that you're interested in.
Definitely. I think that's completely accurate, and that you have to take chances and go to labs where you don't know anything. You know, I walked into the lab and he was telling me to grow cells and I didn't know how to grow cells. And, you know, you just kind of have to dive in and just not be afraid to try things out that you have no idea what they are, because you might end up falling in love with them. And I think that that's a fantastic thing, is to always kind of push the boundaries and get out of your comfort zone and explore lots of different things, especially when you're an undergrad. I mean, you have all, you know, your summers are open, hopefully, and you can do things and really explore.
Agreed. That's exactly what I did during my biochemistry undergrad, is that in the summertime, if I could, I was working in a lab and getting to figure out what I like to do. And I think that's an important point to make to, you know, the junior scientist listening today, is that, you know, just go out there and just experiment. So you're in Michigan, you're doing your PhD. What are some of the topics that you worked on? What did you enjoy during your time in your PhD program?
Sure. So I worked on opioid receptors, and specifically we had allosteric modulators of them. And so when I came into the lab, Dr. Trainer and a few of the collaborators had just discovered these modulators. And so they were the first allosteric modulators of the opioid receptor. And the thought is that instead of directly targeting the receptor, like morphine or buprenorphine, we target it allosterically, we enhance your endogenous tone, we cause pain relief, maybe we mitigate some of these side effects. And so, you know, that was kind of the overall arching theme of the lab. But my project really was trying to understand how these were working. So we had cellular data showing that they would cause shifts in affinity, shifts in potency, but we didn't really know how they worked. We didn't know, were they selective for one opioid receptor over another opioid receptor? Were they actually hitting the receptor, or were they hitting maybe the interface of the receptor G protein? We didn't know all of these very, very basic understandings of how these worked. And so that was my thesis project, really was, you know, breaking it down into an isolated system, understanding, is it working on only the receptor? So is the receptor enough for these to have activity? How are they working? You know, are they affecting only affinity, only efficacy, their selectivity? And then also just trying to understand what they do to more long-term signaling. Because one of the things with opioids is that you oftentimes don't take them once, you take them multiple times. And so understanding then how these modulators would affect not only acute signal transduction, but more long-term things associated with desensitization and tolerance acquisition.
So kind of spanning it. That is so interesting. You said you were describing it, and all I could see is you as a surgeon trying to really dissect all of these molecular pathways and signaling pathways to really create this map of how these allosteric modulators work. What did you enjoy most? Was it the data analysis, or was it generating the data?
Oh, that's such a good question. I think, you know, a lot of times I like just being busy, physically busy, running around the lab, doing a lot of experiments. But then I really did like, at the end of the day, sitting down and seeing, did the data match what we thought? Was it what we predicted? Are we having any surprises? And then kind of, you know, those long conversations that always would occur with your PI or your lab mates, where you're just kind of fantasizing about what if and what could be, and you know, taking your first little nugget of data and blowing it wildly out of proportion, right? As you like to do, and kind of fantasizing about it. So I think that I enjoyed a lot of those factors.
All of them. Yeah, I think when I think back at my time in the lab, especially that the training is so much focused on, you know, getting good, becoming a good experimentalist. For me, it was always easier to, you know, plan an experiment and run the experiment. And then I needed, you know, a break to then sit down and then enjoy analyzing the data. And if I had to choose, I don't think I could choose between doing the experiment at the time, at least doing the experiment and analyzing the data. But I think when you get used to running these experiments and somebody wakes you up at 3 a.m. and you still know what step comes after, you know, step 5, then you kind of get to a point where you want to mentor, you want to teach, and then you want to get to analyze the data because you're asking larger questions. Sure. I was going to say, did you have the same feeling by the end of your PhD?
Yeah, I think one of the things that I really, really enjoyed doing and that Michigan really promoted heavily was doing seminars. So we had to do an hour-long seminar every year, and so from your first year. And so that really kind of forced you to make a story, and to make a story maybe out of 2 graphs, right? That you might not think is a good story, but you've got to build it into a story somehow. And that process really to me was really enjoyable because it combined kind of teaching and storytelling. And that's really my ultimate passion that I really love is teaching. And so that, whether it be teaching in the lab or teaching in a more traditional setting, that's what I really, really love to do. And so that, you know, giving seminars and learning how to craft a story and learning how to teach techniques and learning how to teach methodology and theories behind your field is really, really fun to do.
And even data analysis, I think once it's one important thing to have to set up the correct experiment with the correct controls, have the right data, so run the experiment flawlessly, but then it's still an art to analyze it and to figure out what is the best way to make that data speak, to see if what you did makes sense or not. And one goes with the other, because one without the other is just wasted time and energy in that sense.
Exactly. I completely agree. And there was an old mentor that I had would always talk about, you have to know your assay. And what he meant by that was you have to know what your assay is actually measuring. Right, because you can get this data and you interpret it one way, but if you don't know the nuances, like the very intricacies about your assay, and you don't actually know what the specificity of thing you're measuring is, then you can interpret it in a really wrong way. And so I think it's such an art to analyzing data in an accurate way.
I agree. So yeah, then you complete your PhD, and then what leads you to San Francisco? How come you chose Dr. Van Zastro's lab?
I had always admired his work for a long time, just because it kind of flipped everything upside down for me anyways, because I was coming from a pharmacology equilibrium, radioligand binding, everything's at equilibrium. You're looking at affinity, you're looking at kind of final states. And so to go to Mark's lab where everything is dynamic, everything is moving. This is a live cell where pieces are internalizing, moving, and then to flip it on its head again and say the receptor at the surface might not be the center of the world. And maybe, because a lot of the work that he's done has shown that receptor still signals once it's internalized, right? So for me, that was even more mind-blowing, was that maybe a cell at the membrane him, and then after the interview, just he's brilliant, and the way he thinks about science is just... Yeah. How could you say that?
Yeah, absolutely. I think he has a very unique way of approaching these questions, and the methods developed in his lab are really, really a form of art. Mm-hmm. When you look at it, and it's so nice to be able to track these events live in the cells and better understand on a dynamic, platform how things happen.
Right. And that's something that I wanted to be incorporated into my training was, taking things from membranes is good and well, but thinking about it in a cellular context where there's things that are moving and breathing is, I think, fundamental in order to getting things out that could be useful in drug discovery. So I really wanted that kind of aspect in my training.
That is awesome. Did you, just for the sake of the junior audience listening, did you interview at different labs? How did you come up to choosing your postdoc? Or how did it go out for you? Because the reason I'm bringing this up is that we've talked about, you know, exploring in undergrad and doing rotations in different labs and exposing yourself to different environments. But I think that becomes important throughout your entire life, not only your career. Can you touch a little bit on that?
Sure. And it is a little bit scary choosing your postdoc, right? Because when you choose your graduate school, you get a whole weekend there and you get to meet people. And then when you choose your PhD lab, you get rotations where you get to spend several months with them. So choosing your postdoc for me was a little bit scary just because you didn't get that trial period. You didn't get to try it out. And so I did a lot of emails, really going through the network, going through my mentors' networks, talking to a lot of people. I was fortunate enough to go to a lot of conferences during my PhD, which I think is another extremely beneficial thing to do, just because, again, it exposes you to so many people, so many different labs. So I had some connections through conferences, and from there, just set up a number of interviews, kind of on-site interviews, and then you just go with your gut after that. But I think, you know, doing due diligence and talking to people that they've mentored, looking at their mentoring track record, I mean, all these things are accessible and important things to look for in terms of choosing that mentor.
I think you did the right, you had the right mindset, and you did the right thing putting yourself out there and meeting people and talking to people at conferences. Well, we're still in COVID times, although the vaccine, the Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine has been approved, but we're not out of the woods yet. But still, I think meeting people in person and seeing what they're working on and meeting students, now we can do it online. You can send out emails. It's crucial for you to get a picture of who that person is, who that lab, what lab it is, what's the atmosphere, you know. And I think it's kind of like finding the right partner. You need to make sure that you feel comfortable in that environment, and that environment is there to support you, but at the same time that they're comfortable with you as well.
Speaking of kind of these COVID times and things, another really useful tool, and it's actually how I found you, was through LinkedIn, yeah. Right? I think, reaching out to people, because LinkedIn, you can see connections, you can see the resume, everything. And, you know, I've done a number of informational interviews with people on LinkedIn, just kind of everybody's at home, set up a Zoom and talk and meet people that way too. So I think that there's, we have to be flexible. Everything's new, but I think there's a lot of exciting ways that we can connect with people right now.
I think so too. And you touched on two very, very important keywords to me. One is LinkedIn. A lot of academics do not have a LinkedIn profile. And I would recommend, please, please, please make yourself a LinkedIn profile. That's how people, recruiters, potential employers, potential collaborators will find you now. One piece of advice, use a professional picture. Not you looking in the microscope on your LinkedIn. And I think make sure that, you know, you put yourself out there. And one of the best ways of doing it right now is through LinkedIn. The other important point that you touched upon is informational interviews. So briefly, what that means is that you just talk to people to see what they're doing and try and figure out if you like it or not. And forming connections. And I was very happy to see that you reached out to me, and, you know, we ended up having discussions. And look, today we're here recording this episode. And if neither of us has a LinkedIn profile and you don't reach out to me and I don't respond to you, then we wouldn't be here.
Exactly. And it's always, you never know what's going to happen, right? You never know what is going to lead to what and what things will be years from now. So I think I completely agree. I wish more academics were on LinkedIn because it's so useful. It's so, so useful.
Absolutely. And if I can plug it in, a lot of academics actually in the GPCR field are on LinkedIn. Not everyone. That's why I'm urging younger students and PhDs and postdocs as well to come on LinkedIn. We do have a Dr. GPCR club, which is private group where we share information. If you have any questions or things like that, you're welcome to join the group. All I need to know is you are in the GPCR field, because I want to make sure that the members are specific to the field. Speaking of groups, so now you're doing your postdoc and you're learning brand new techniques, brand new ways of looking at receptor function, even after the receptor gets internalized. What kind of receptors did you work on?
So adrenergic receptors, beta 2 mainly.
Okay.
Yep.
It's a very different from the opioid receptors, but it's a very nice system that allowed so many wonderful discoveries.
Definitely. And it was a mindset change for me, because I was always interested in opioid receptors because of their clear benefit to a pain state, right? Clear benefit to a patient. Whereas beta 2 is oftentimes studied as the model system. And it is the model system, right? Because just such a plethora of information is out there. Every ligand, every construct, everything is out there. And so it was a mindset change for me going from thinking about the patient to a model system. I mean, clinically relevant it is. I still agree that beta can be clinically relevant, but it's really not the basis for its use in research a lot of times.
Yeah, and I think the beauty of the beta 2 adrenergic system is that, yes, as you mentioned, a lot of assays were developed, a lot of discoveries are associated, beta arrestin, G proteins. Well, actually, I'm not sure about G proteins, but beta arrestins, GRKs, and there is a plethora of ligands available. So you can really, really dissect, and it's kind of like a model receptor, which, by the way, is one of the favorite receptors, or the favorite receptors of Dr. Bob Lefkowitz, as I recently learned. What kind of techniques did you learn in during your postdoc?
So more microscopy techniques, right? So confocal, getting to see kind of palm and storm. I never got to touch those, but kind of seeing them and seeing turf microscopy and seeing all these different aspects and seeing just live cell imaging was, because all the other microscopy I'd been exposed to previously was just slides, right? Stained slides. And so really live cell imaging was the bulk of the techniques that I learned there.
That's awesome. I think it's a form of art. I think microscopy in itself, just because I'm not good at it at all and haven't had a chance to really learn it. But when you're looking at live cells, I think it's just such a beautiful art. And it's teachable, it's learnable, but it takes a long time to really master it.
Definitely. And I am not a master at all. I did not reach that point, but it was, you know, some of the movies and things that would come up in lab meetings were just beautiful. It was just, like you said, it was art. And it was such a unique way to see science because I had only seen it as data that I had interpreted from some instrument, right? I just pulled numbers off. And to actually be able to see the cell and see things moving around was just, it is art. It's art.
And then what led you to your current position? And before you answer that, my next question will be, what do you do? Because you have a cryptic, to a lot of people, a cryptic title. But let's start with number one. What led you to your current position?
Sure. So, you know, through a lot of soul searching, I realized that kind of the grant life wasn't for me. I wasn't on the path of kind of the R01 research lab with the grants. And so I was looking for other opportunities, and I found this position at Gator Bio that I initially joined as a field application scientist, which might also be a foreign term to a lot of people. But I think it's actually a fantastic job for people who've gotten PhDs and who like people, because it's kind of, it's a blend of teaching in the industry sector. So it's, you become kind of the liaison of the customer who's a scientist to the company. And so you teach them methodologies, you teach them how to use instrumentation, you learn about their applications. And so that's what brought me to that role as a field application scientist, was that it was a teaching scientist job. So it was a little bit on the bench, a little bit customer facing, a little bit teaching, and it's what really drew me to it, because I had never heard of it before. But it was a lot of fun because you get to meet so many people, you get to talk to scientists from the academic sector, from the industry, from big pharma, and learn what they're doing, and then teach them and help them in their science. And so it was a really fun position, and that's what attracted me to that company.
And then when did you first start thinking about what's next for you during your postdoc, and how did you go about, you know, kind of deciding which position you'd be going for outside of academia? Because as was clear, you just mentioned that you realized that going the academic route was not for you. Then once you made that decision, how did you, you know, go, when, how did you go about your career to get to that field application position?
Sure. I think what for me was trying, you know, once you kind of figure out what you like and what you don't like, it's really focusing on what you like and figuring out why do you like it? Right. And so for me, it was like, okay, well, why did I like mentoring undergrads? Okay. I liked teaching people. I liked meeting people. I liked seeing their eyes light up when they figured something out. You know, so it's kind of going through the things that you like doing and understanding what are the commonalities behind them. And then it was just kind of getting online and finding out what positions are available and what things are. And there's a lot of resources online that you can see industry jobs and what they're built for and what kind of personality types they adapt to. And I think that FAS is one of those that was constantly listed. It was just kind of, you like to be interfacing with people. You like to keep in touch with the novel science, but you don't maybe want to do bench work all the time. And so that's kind of what led me to an FAS position. But I, to be, not to plug LinkedIn again, but that is how I found the job, was applying through LinkedIn.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So if we were to kind of narrow it down and take the points that you just made, is that, so step, if we look at it as a protocol, step one, figure out where you want to go. Do you like it, or do you like academia or not? Where do you see yourself? Step two, figure out what is it that makes you happy on a day-to-day activity basis. And then step three would be to, you know, make sure that you are a valued candidate for the positions that you're going after. We talked about LinkedIn, but making sure that your resume is up to date and it's not a CV, it's a nice resume where you actually show the employer that you not only have a PhD, but you also have this, the people skills that they're looking for. And then I think I totally agree with you when it comes to the field application scientist positions, is that it's a nice blend of the technical part and of the people facing skills, because you get to talk to scientists. So you're still using your PhD, you're still helping others solve their problems, whether they're in academic setting or industry setting. But at the same time, you're learning, for example, how the industry works.
Definitely, definitely. And that's a good question for, do you want to go to a big company or a small company? Because those have vastly different cultures and accessibilities to fresh graduates. And so I think that's another big decision to make if you do choose to go to industry, is what kind of industry? Is it a big pharma or is it a startup? And so for me, I chose the startup just because I wanted the excitement. I wanted a little bit of chaos. I wanted to be able to learn a lot and have accessibility that you might not get in a big pharma. But again, that's another question that you have to ask yourself, is just kind of what level of structure do you want? What level of boundaries do you want and need? And also, what's your future look like? How do you want to grow?
Agreed. And it touches back again on the point that you made about informational interviews. So unfortunately, you cannot experience all the types of jobs that are out there before you pick one career path. And that's what informational interviews are for, is try and find some of the positions that you might be interested in, reach out to people and say, hey, I'm a fresh graduate. Your position or your work looks very interesting. Do you have 5 minutes to tell me more about what you're doing on a day-to-day basis? And that, have you had a chance to do that while you were narrowing down your career path in industry?
I did. I spent, again, on LinkedIn, just kind of looking at different job positions. And I think people were very open to it, because I was very nervous, because I thought these people are very busy. They have such big titles. They don't know who I am. But you'd be surprised at how willing people are to help if you just send an email, especially if you phrase it like you did. Do you have 5 minutes, right? Do you have 5 minutes for a phone call, right? You don't make it up to be this large meeting, but just, do you have 5 minutes? And everybody has five. And more oftentimes those 5 minute interviews would turn into 30 minute phone calls. Right. And it's just that, and people like talking about themselves too, to be frank, right? So if you're calling up and you just want to hear about somebody's life and how they got there and, you know, what mistakes did they make and what do they like, then I think there, a lot of people are really willing to talk. So I really strongly urge people to try, just because you never know. And what's the worst? They ignore it. Move on.
Exactly. There are so many people on LinkedIn anyway, or, you know, who are willing to help. So as you mentioned, I love the fact that you just said, you know, you're right. People like to talk about themselves, and just make sure that when you reach out, you're respectful, you're nice, and you don't ask for a job. You just want to know how they do. The reason I'm saying this is because I've gotten messages from people from all over the world that said, you know, I love your organization and I'm looking for a job. Here's my resume. I hope you can hire me.
And <That's bold. laughs>
yes, I thought it was very bold. And it did just, and then I think the worst part of it that I found like really odd, that when I looked at the message, it said something like, I'm great, I'm the best, and you, like, it would be in your interest to hire me, where there was no positions open. I'm in no position of hiring anyone from around the world. So just, I'm saying this as an example of what not to do, but I think the best way to go about it is just to say, hey, this is what I'm trying to figure out, where I'm going next. I love the position that you're in. If you can just give me 5 minutes and tell me your story, I want to say 99.9% of the people you reach out to will respond and will give you that 5 minutes. And I've heard stories of people who reached out to do these informational interviews, and it ended up in a job offer or in a job interview. And you never know.
But I agree with you that you can't enter it with that mindset. You can't enter it with any expectations, and you have to be well prepared and not be sneaky about it. I think just be genuine in your interest.
Exactly. Just be curious towards other people. Figure out what they do. Worst case scenario, they don't respond. Best case scenario, you end up with a great connection, and you know, maybe not tomorrow, maybe not next week, maybe not next year, but you never know when, you know, things go around and you can make an introduction to them and you can help them out and vice versa. So you're in FAS, you're in the Bay Area at Gator Bio. And then how come you transferred to becoming a product manager, and what is a product manager?
Sure. Yes. I still have not answered that. Internally, we had a transfer just because we needed a product manager and we didn't have that. And I kind of was really eager to move to the marketing sphere. And so I transitioned into that role. And so that role it means a lot of different things at a lot of different companies. So I'll preface it with that it means different things at different companies. So for my job, what I do is a lot of understanding the market, understanding what people are doing, and understanding how we can fix it and make it easier. And so that was what really drew me to it, was because it was taking some of the aspects of FAS that you see on a day-to-day basis, but turning them into larger projects, right? Because now you see, you know, okay, they want to understand GPCR, G-protein interactions. I think our technology can do that. So let's figure out a protocol. Let's get some academic collaborators. Let's figure it out. And let's make this into a product that can be used by people. And so I think that's what really drew me to it, was the ability to take these ideas and these pain points that customers were having them and turn them into tangible things that they can do. So that's what a lot of my work is on, is just kind of understanding what customers are looking for and help turn those into products.
That is such a great answer. And again, you touched on a very important point, is that you do have a PhD, you do have a postdoc in a very specific field when you look at it globally, and then still you were able to translate those skills that you acquired during your training into being a field application scientist. And now you're adding to those skills the marketing. So the take-home message, at least from my perspective, is with a PhD, whether it's, you know, in the GPCR field or any field, you can learn new skills easily because you've learned how to think about problems, how to identify pitfalls, and how to solve those problems.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. And I think that one of the things that helped me a lot and currently helps me in this role is previous exposure to a lot of techniques. And so I think this goes also back to trying new things and exploring, is even techniques that maybe I had never done, but my roommate had done it before and I'd heard her complaining about it, or I saw it at a journal club presentation. And so kind of, again, like relearning new techniques and seeing different ways of doing this, different ways of answering the same question, I think is also very helpful, because you learn from other protocols, you learn from other techniques. You see mistakes that other techniques have, and you don't want to make those yourself. So I think that, like you said, it's the skill set and the training that come behind this really open up a lot of doors. And I think that one of the ways to keep those doors open is just to constantly be reading about new things and seeing how everything is always connected, even if you don't think it is.
Yes, agreed. Again, I can only agree with you. The other question I had for you is, so you've been in academia for your PhD and your postdoc. What size of labs were you in Michigan and then in San Francisco?
Oh, gosh. And Michigan was quite the roller coaster, because Michigan, I was in that lab when it was like 3 people, and then I was in that lab when it was 20 people.
Wow.
And vastly different funding situations in between. So that one, it was kind of spanned it. And then at UCSF, the lab was bigger, I think probably 15 mm-hmm. people or so.
So the reason I was asking is because depending on which size of a community we're working, whether you're in an academic lab or in a company, the dynamic changes between people. And my next question was, how did the dynamic change between the labs, but also between your current position, or actually between the two positions that you've occupied now at Gator Bio?
That's an interesting question. I think it's gotten a lot. That's a very interesting question. So, you know, in the lab, right, you're surrounded by scientists. And when you go to a company now, especially in these different roles, then you're surrounded by people from all different backgrounds. And so that's been something that I've loved tremendously, is now my interfaces as, I mean, I love scientists, I love them. But, you know, now I get to interface with manufacturing and QC and quality and R&D and all of these different departments that, to be honest, I didn't even know what they were. And so I think that that's been really exciting, is interfacing with a lot of different people who have a lot of different backgrounds who maybe are not scientists. And then also adding in the customer dynamic too is an interesting dynamic that you didn't really experience in the lab. I don't know if I'm answering your question right.
Yes. Yes, you are. And it's so interesting because you mentioned that, you know, the customer experience, you didn't kind of experience it from the lab. Well, actually you did when you were talking to sales reps or, you know, account managers, but from the other end of it.
That's true.
Which is different as well. The reason I was asking is because, again, it goes back to the openness of, you know, going out there, exploring opportunities and reaching out to people, whether you're on LinkedIn, whether it's in the context of your position, whether it's an FAS or product manager, is that with a PhD, yes, you can talk very specifics with scientists, but also you can talk to the marketing folks, you can talk to the QC, to the R&D, to the other product managers, and you can adapt to all of these. And sometimes it can be difficult because, you know, I'm just thinking about abbreviations that are different, you know, 2-3 letters put together for you say mean something, and then for others mean something else. So for example, the two words that the two examples that come into mind, actually one, RA can be research assistant or research associate, but RA can also be research area. So depending on who you're talking to, you have to be able to adapt to these things.
Sure. And it's, yeah, like you said, it's not only different jargon, but then also different, their top two of what's most important about something is vastly different. And that's what you need, especially, you know, now that we make analytical instrumentation, right? We're making instruments for people to use. And so for that, I definitely want a group who made it that has every value as their most important, right? So that when you come together, all the values have been covered. But it makes those conversations very interesting to have, where you're trying to discuss issues that maybe you've never even thought about it. And it's just such a learning process.
I think it's really fascinating. Tell us a little bit more about how your typical day looks like.
I don't know if there is a typical day.
How your atypical day looks like. I'd want to say in both in an FAS role and in a product manager role.
Sure. So an FAS role maybe is a bit more streamlined. Maybe I can comment a bit more on that one. So FAS role, a lot of what you're going to be doing is not only working with current customers, so answering their questions, you know, how do I analyze this data? What does this KOF mean? You're going to be doing that, but you're also going to be working with pre-sale. So people who have not purchased something yet, you're going to want to be doing sample workups or showing them how the instrument works or answering their technical questions or things like that. So you're going to be doing a lot of that. And you're going to also be doing some more kind of internal development of new products that we're making, kind of taking that voice of customer and turning it into tangible things that we can check off a checklist. Yeah. So it's, And back in the pre-COVID days, it would be a lot of trade shows and a lot of customer visits and going on site and talking face-to-face to customers.
That's I think that makes a lot of sense. So the other question I had for you is, what would be your advice? And we talked a lot about this, but if we kind of narrow it down or recap, what would be your advice to PhD students and postdocs who realize that they don't want to continue in academia, but want to join an industry in any potential position, knowing that there are so many choices out there?
Sure. I think number one is to not feel bad about it, because I think we always make this joke of you're going to the dark side, you're going to the dark side, and it really gets ingrained in you in academia. And I heard those jokes. I think I made those jokes, but it really gets ingrained with you. So I think first and foremost is it's okay. It's okay if you don't want to go to academia. It's okay if you don't want to be a professor. Number two, I think like we touched on is really understanding what you're good at, what you're truly good at, and what you truly like, because ideally you'll want to find some overlap with that and find a position that's out there. And I think that that's when you need to start just kind of Googling online. There's so many references for what are different jobs within the public sector that you can do. So I think that getting information and just diving in and getting research, either from talking to people who've made the jump into industry or just kind of deep diving online and LinkedIn and talking to people. So I think, you know, number two is just to learn about yourself, learn what you like and what you're good at. And then number three is to learn about the industry and learn about, you know, big or small company, customer facing role or internal bench or this, right? And there's a lot of internships that you can do. There's a lot of industry postdocs, right? You can do an industry postdoc just to kind of get a flavor. So I think that there's avenues out there, but I think that would be my three steps is number one, it's okay. Number two, kind of understand yourself and what you like to do. And number three is really dive into the industry, talk to people, don't be afraid to ask, figure out what's out there because there's so many positions out there. There's so many positions that I had no idea.
Yeah. And you could, I love the fact that you said, yes, son, it's okay. It is okay. And it is not the dark side. I think both sides are complementary nowadays. And I also grew up, quote unquote, as a young scientist in this belief that, you know, it's the dark side. It's not. I think both sides need each other. You need academics to do that, you know, free thinking and do the cool stuff. It's not the right expression. Do things more freely and develop and just make discoveries. But that doesn't mean that in industry you cannot do that. It just means that in industry the priorities are different and you have to decide which one you want to live with.
Exactly.
And if I may add, I think a lot of companies, a lot of in industry have realized that people need that you know, freedom. So sometimes you would get 10, 20% of your time free to work on anything you're interested in. And the resources in an industry setting are completely different than in academia. So I think it's just for you to figure out what you want to do.
Yeah, and I completely agree because it's that, like you said, they're completely complementary because both can do things that the other can't. Because, you know, in industry, you can't spend 15 years trying to solve one problem. There's no way. Right? You can't have that persistence because it's economically not viable. But in academia, you also can't screen 30 million cell lines in an afternoon, or maybe not an afternoon. It's just they're completely different skill sets and they completely complement each other. And I think that more collaboration should happen. I mean, that's how my PhD was even started, was an academic industry collaboration. And without that, we would have never found those modulators and it would have been completely different. So I think those collaborations are essential.
And I think they're more and more frequent and they're more and more made public in that sense. And I think industry is always very interested in what academia is doing and vice versa, because and I think we both agree, and I hope the audience as well, is that they're complementary to each other. The funding levels are different. Sorry.
Yeah, that's why I love Dr. GPCR, because that's what you're doing, is you're bringing these people together to have these open dialogues and these open forums. So I completely agree.
Thank you. And I think that's one of the things I realized over during my time at the bench and working, you know, in a biotech company, but also in academia, is that my biggest issue was finding the information or finding, you know, that collaborator or finding that technology and not being able to solve a small problem. But if you have the network and if you have the contacts and if you know who to talk to, someone in the afternoon, you know, between two meetings in front of a coffee can tell you, well, you know, I tried this 10 years ago and it didn't work, and we're ready to move on. And that's what actually promotes collaboration. That's what promotes, you know, moving science forward, because at the end of the day, that has always been my goal, moving scientific discoveries forward in order to help patients and humans in general.
I love it. I love it.
Super. Thank you so much, Catherine. What the last question I wanted to ask you is, where can people find you? I know I think we touched on the answer, but I'm still going to ask you that.
The answer, LinkedIn, of course. So I'm on there, Catherine E. Livingston. I added the middle initial, which helps just to keep be visible. So yes, I'm on LinkedIn. I'm happy to answer questions to anybody if they have questions about leaving academia or I can finally tell you what a product manager actually does, or anything. Like that, I'm happy to talk to people.
Super. And if you're in my contacts, you can find Catherine within my contacts as well on LinkedIn very easily. Thank you so much, Catherine, for your time. I think it was a lovely discussion.
Yes, thank you so much.
Of course. Thank you so much. Talk to you soon.
Bye.
Thank you for joining us for this Dr. GPCR podcast episode. I'd like to thank our guest, as well as our team members, Attila Forrest, Shivani Sajdev, and Jin Chung. Please subscribe to the Dr. GPCR newsletter, find us on YouTube, and if you like our podcast, leave us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts. Another way to support us is to share the podcast, the newsletter, and the virtual cafe with your colleagues. Email us with any questions or suggestions at hello@drgpcr.com. Until next time, stay safe.